A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
When Diplomacy Fails presents.
Hello and welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hey guys, welcome to When Diplomacy Fails. Welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hello and welcome to
Hello
When Diplomacy
Hello and welcome
fails.
To When Diplomacy Fails.
A project 5 years in the making.
The Franco-Prussian War.
The 7 Years War.
Of the When Diplomacy Fails special on Napoleon.
The Crimean War.
To When Diplomacy Fails special on World War I.
The Dutch Revolt.
To the When Diplomacy Fails special on the 30 Years' War.
The July Crisis Anniversary Project.
The Swedish Deluges.
Britain goes to war.
The 1916.
To the Franco-Dutch War of 1672.
This is When Diplomacy Fails Remastered. Hello, history friends. This is the promised collaboration episode that I did with Jordan Harbour from the Twilight Histories podcast. Basically, in this, if you enjoy your alternative history, if your appetite was whetted by that little deep dive topic that I did, which, if you're a patron for When Diplomacy Fails, you will get all 4 episodes of, rather than just 2, but that's another story. Today we are here to tell the story about 4 different alternative history deep dives that Jordan Harbour and I go into. Jordan Harbour is a great guy, he's a great podcaster, and if you would like to find out more about him or track down his science fiction alternative reality projects, then go to twilighthistories.com. It's all one word, all lowercase, very straightforward. Jordan Harbour, like myself, has been doing this for a very long time, and well, we've kind of been running parallel to each other in terms of podcasting and really how long we've been doing this for. We've both learned a lot during our times in podcasting, and well, we've both grown a lot as well, as you'll discover. So yeah, it was great to have him on, because it kind of, during the course of this 5-year project, I've kind of brought on a lot of people who've, well, been with me, not necessarily since the beginning, but certainly for a good long time. And there's a few more of them to come, so hope you'll stick with us. As well as some surprises, there's also some classical history podcasters, which you'll all enjoy. Today though, as we know, it's Jordan Harbour's turn, and he ranks among those classical history podcasters. He deserves your attention. He's a very talented guy. So if you're ready, history friends, let's go to some strange and mysterious worlds. Helped, if you're brave enough, by yours truly and Jordan Harbour. Enjoy, guys. Okay, guys, back on the podcast, and today we have a very special guest because, even though it's a collaboration episode with a rather significant podcaster, this podcaster is not coming in to talk about an episode in the 19 previous episodes per se. He's coming in instead to talk about alternative history, science fiction, world building. Ladies and gentlemen, history friends, today we have Jordan Harbour from the Twilight Histories podcast. How are you doing, Jordan?
So great to be a part of your show today.
Oh, you're very welcome. You're very, very welcome. Well, I'm very excited. This is going to be a very interesting podcast to talk about what ifs and what might have been, and I think those kinds of discussions will always draw people in. They're always so like people will speculate for hours on end about what might have been. So we've got a good amount of content that we can tackle. So where would you like to start?
Well, I was thinking just to sort of get our feet wet, maybe we could just talk about kind of how to approach alternate history.
Because sure.
I think sort of the general way people approach it is they're kind of unidirectional, or, you know, they'll say, this is how it had to have happened if something else, if there was a point of divergence and then it goes off in another direction. And how I kind of look at it is there's an unlimited number of different directions that it can go into. So it's, you know, as soon as you press the button, change the world, everything changes. So, I mean, right down to, you know, what sperm goes to the egg, like the entire next generation is different. So that's kind of how I like to start it, is it's a completely blank slate. You know, if you change something in 1700, Napoleon isn't born. You know, there is no George Washington that becomes a mobster or something. You know, like that whole generation is just not there. And
right.
So we start from scratch.
Okay.
So that's sort of the main rule of how I start to world build. And then after that, because I'm a science fiction writer, I write alternate history in sort of locked in that sort of genre of science fiction. I like to make a world fascinating. I like to make it exotic. I like to make it, you know, I don't want it to be just slightly different so that someone might, you know, read the story and maybe, you know, the French Revolution happens, you know, 10 years this way or 10 years that way. Like,
sure,
that's not very exotic. Like, it's got to be like really exotic, you know,
yeah,
something that people are like, whoa, that's different. So that's kind of that's sort of the general framework where I start to build a new world. But I understand you've got a number of worlds that are a number of points of divergence that you want to talk about. And I think we can create some great worlds out of those. So we can just sort of chat those through.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, do you know what? I realized that I tend to forget my I have a very loose structure as it is, but I tend to forget my rough structure is say hello and then introduce the podcaster, which I realize I just forgot to do. So before we get into the actual content, maybe I should just ask you to describe Twilight History's podcast and what it's all about.
My little preamble there, you kind of get an idea of what I do. I do science fiction. My show is each show is about an hour long, and it's sort of soundscaped. It's got music and sound effects, and I take you to a different world. And each world is completely different from the world that you had explored the time before. You know, it has new characters, and, you know, these are short stories, essentially, that are kind of dramatized. And, you know, they're exciting to make, and they're exciting to listen to, I hope. And, and you know, it's just a joy in my life.
Yeah, well, I must say, no, you're very good at it, and even judging from the episodes themselves, not necessarily the time it takes in between them to make, it's clear that a lot of hard work goes into each episode. How long roughly does it take you to make each one?
For years, I've thought to actually write down the amount of hours that goes into it, but it's just so hard because, I mean, I'll walk the dog or I'll walk to work and I'll be thinking about it and sort of be lost in it, or I'll have a shower and I'll be thinking about new characters or different elements of the world. So how do you sort of log all this time stitched together? It's just this constant sort of thing that, you know, when I start a new world and start a new story, you know, it just takes over. And so it's hard to say. I do have three kids now. I didn't have three kids when I first started this podcast a number of years ago. So I'm in a completely different phase in my life. So the shows that I put out don't come out very often, but I do have a membership area, and I have to sort of keep them fed. So I produce a show for them once a month.
Cool.
And right now I'm working on a Twilight Histories book. But we can get into that, you know, at the end. You know,
by all means, we'll have plenty of opportunities to plug. Don't you worry. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, I really want to get into the meat of this, though. I'm so excited to go through some of these worlds that you dreamt up.
Well, I think the first one, I want to start with the first one that I alluded to, then mentioned to you. It goes back to the episode 8, which was the American Revolution. And or American War of Independence, whatever you want to call it. And now it's in 1774 is the date. The Continental Congress is trying to vote on what alternatives the 13 colonies should pursue. And now it should be borne in mind that only 12 of the 13 states are attending. Georgia doesn't attend because Georgia is still, at least on the surface, at least loyal to the crown. So doesn't want to take part in this Continental Congress treasonous activity. But the 12 states that do send representatives, they vote on the alternatives. And one of these alternatives posed was the idea of a dual monarchy with Britain, whereby the British and the Americans would essentially, now I the Americans wouldn't elect a king of their own, but they would have a parliament of their own, which would have a kind of representative, a Lord Lieutenant, if you like, that would then report back to the British king. And it's a similar model, although it certainly would have worked differently, to the Irish. The idea this was posed in Ireland in the 1900s, throughout the early 1800s and 1900s as well, just to try and find a solution to the Irish question, it was called, because the Irish were so rebellious, but you couldn't trust them to have them by themselves. So maybe some kind of limited self-rule would be the best option. So it seems like even though the American colonies weren't necessarily super rebellious at this point, the thing that really got me, the thing that really drew me in about this whole scenario was the fact that this whole idea of dual monarchy, which was so fundamentally different to what America became. Mm-hmm. That whole idea, it was defeated in the Continental Congress by one vote.
Yeah, yeah.
and to me, that was, I just can't believe no one's really talked much about it. I remember I saw one alternative history about, it was What If America, it was called. The idea of Britain and America being welded together in modern times, I think, is a fascinating one, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, I think this is a fascinating premise to start on. And you look at it, and one of the things is that there's a lot of Americans, or, you know, colonials at this time that really didn't want to leave Britain. You know, this is high treason. You know, yeah. It's a very painful experience to commit treason. You know, this is something like, you've been brought up with viewing the monarchy, you know, inherently a part of your self-identity. You've pledged allegiance to the monarchy, and then to you know, commit treason against that. That's a very painful process. So there are many people that didn't want to do it, and many that came up to Canada during the revolution. I think what Britain was trying to do throughout these very troubled years was to try and find a compromise during a time when there was just this growing sort of emotion of distrust and hatred. You know, they'd just gone through what was it called, the Indian Wars, or the,
also known as the 7 Years' War in
the 7 Years. Yeah. So I mean, this was like the first world war. You know, before a lot of these people, they had fought on the side of Britain, and they identified themselves as Britons. And so, but when they came back, they discovered that Britain was starting to tax them more and pull away their rights. And then the colonials were starting to throw eggs at the soldiers who had just, you know, fought for them, presumably. Yeah. And so there was all this conflict going on. It would be really interesting to see if Britain was able to find a negotiated peace through this. And it is plausible. I mean, Canada's was kind of like that. But then the question is, for the purposes of your world building, is what are the conflicts? Does that solve the conflicts, or does it just, you know, press them down and extend them out to a later date? So then you're dealing with, you know, a revolutionary war that's on completely different terms, you know, in a completely different generation. So maybe it's like two or three generations later. It's in the deep 1800s. So and that would be a fascinating world to set it in, wouldn't it?
Like the American Revolution, it's not just the surface results, which is important to remember. The actual things that the American War for Independence inspired, just like the French Revolution, for example, arguably now you could make a case that without the American War for Independence, France would never have been so bankrupted, because the French had supported the Americans monetarily and militarily, and it essentially bankrupted France. With the result that it was really unable to defend its own regime by the time the French Revolution rolled around. But also, of course, the actual people of France, they were inspired by the ideals and values and principles like liberty, equality, fraternity, like those things, they come together, but they're certainly recognizable in America beforehand. Like, this idea that the rights are being taken away was, I mean, the French had been ruled for years by an absolutist monarch, and it's only once the Americans start saying we're sick of a faceless monarch here that the French start to say, yeah, we're kind of sick of ours as well.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, and what also what happens here is that you have a balance of power in Europe that is, you know, is just dominated by Britain, and there's no end to it. You know, I mean, France is just screwed.
Yeah.
Right? Like what? Like there's no way to recoup if you have America as a vassal of Great Britain. You know, for centuries, if it stays that way.
Sure.
But
yeah.
But you know, maybe it doesn't. Maybe these ideas still ferment and erupt later.
When we look at an example like the American War for Independence, this very specific kind of event in history that leads to a very obvious result in the independence of the 13 colonies and then America. Mm-hmm. I mean, where should we start if we're going to world build? Should we?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, like even look at the fact, like would a non-independent 13 colonies, would they have been as eager to expand? I mean, would they have had manifest destiny and would they want to spread to the West? I mean, would that still have been an issue, do you think? Do you think that it's fair to say that other powers, I mean, might have jumped in there? I mean, the Russians had Alaska until 1869, so...
Well, yeah, well there you go. And you would have had, you know, the Spanish colonies, which had, you know, had their own revolutions. And I'm not sure if Britain would have had open immigration to, you know, say, Eastern Europe in the 1800s. As they did, you know, it would have been mostly confined to the East Coast and the center and the West would have been largely Spanish.
Yeah, yeah, and it also it's worth bearing in mind what Britain could have done with these 13 colonies, basically like reinforcing its power. You could say, I mean, with the power of the 13 colonies and knowing how much America grew in population over the coming years. And how much of a power it became in its own right, even before like the 20th century, it was considerably powerful in America, like on the continent, especially once it defeated Mexico. So by then, I mean, could a case be made for Britain becoming kind of a superpower, like even before like the later Industrial Revolution and its Indian Empire and all that kind of thing? Could a case be made for Britain just becoming unstoppable on the world stage?
Yeah, well, I mean, once we roll the die, you know, we can do whatever we want. We can make that world suit our needs, because you can always sort of say, well, you know, according to this particular, you know, strain of history, we say that all the optimal things always happen in order to make that happen. And I think that could be a very fascinating world. When do you want to set it is a question of when is the most fascinating time to set it. And that would probably be when purposes of a story,
sure.
It's when the conflicts are at their ripest. So, and the question is, what kind of conflicts are we dealing with? Are we dealing with internal conflicts, like between the state and the people? Is it a class warfare thing? Is it a religious issue between, you know, Protestant and Anglican? Or are we dealing with an external threat? You know, maybe there's war brewing. You know, maybe Spain and France team up and now we have a war between Louisiana and teaming up with the Spanish colonies against these British colonies. And you could set it in, you know, the deep south with this kind of war going on. I mean, you can do that and it would be really fascinating.
Sure, yeah. There's also, if you want to put it another way, Spain lost its American colonies. It lost Mexico and everything essentially in South America while it was basically fighting for its survival against Napoleon. And now we already mentioned, without the American Revolution, arguably there might not have been a French Revolution. You could follow that train of logic into thinking, well, without the French Revolution, there would be no invasion of Spain. Therefore, there would be no Spanish losing of its colonies, which would mean really that imperialism and colonialism in the old style, like laying claim to vast swathes of continents as Spain had done and as other countries had done, like that could continue far on into the future.
And you know, sometimes what I like to do is sort of take conflicts and sort of pile them up on top of each other until you create some weird thing that happens where the conflicts sort of weave themselves together. So for instance, you have this idea of enlightenment and freedom and a republic, which was suppressed in the 1700s. And maybe it's still sort of under the surface as kind of this revolutionary current that's spreading, sort of like communism did in the 1800s and into the early 20th century. You have this backdrop of the Enlightenment sort of brewing. You have the colonies of France, Spain, and Britain fighting a hot war. And then you could have something like a Christmas truce between them, between sort of the Republican sides on both sides, right? Where, you know, these sort of radical Republican libertarian types are sort of come together and say, no, we're not going to fight each other. You know, it would be a good, you know, backdrop for a story.
Yeah, absolutely. In line with that, in line with how impactful ideologically the French Revolution was for European thought, I mean, it led then arguably led to the 1848 revolutions, which were hugely impactful and kind of tore the old world asunder. Also led the way, of course. I mean, without no Napoleon, there is no Napoleon III. And without no Napoleon III, arguably, there's no Franco-Prussian War, which, I mean, this is the danger of connecting all these events that seen by themselves aren't, I mean, you could say they're not connected. But when you look at the train of history going into the past and how important certain figures are, if you take those figures out, I mean, it's the great man of history idea that I've talked about with other podcasters. And every now and then you come across examples that make you think, wow, you know, if that person wasn't there, everything would have been different.
Right, right. And you bring up a good point about the great man, because, you know, alternate historical thought experiments do often is they remove the great men. And then they're just playing by economics in their alternate history version. And kind of what I like to do as a science fiction guy or fiction guy is I like to put new great men in, you know, great men that didn't exist. But create, you know, you have this scenario where you have this sort of place where there's an opportunity. Great man is able to move in and take advantage of that opportunity. And he has a name that you've never heard before.
Yeah.
But he comes and he takes it. And there's something really quite fun and fascinating about that.
Well, there is. But the issue with that is that, I mean, you could take something like that anywhere. You must have great fun, like, inventing people to kind of put into these power vacuums, really, and send them towards these storms of interlocking events and see what happens, kind of thing. I suppose it is a role.
Yeah, there's your character, or maybe that's a character that's sort of talked about, and your main characters are like soldiers that are experiencing the war, and the great man is sort of the person that they always refer to, but you never actually see it. This person in the story, right? So,
yeah,
I mean, there's great men in history, even when it's alternate history. So what's your next one?
Cool. Okay. So changing the tempo a little bit, even 5 years ago when I did the episode on the Great Northern War, where basically you saw the power of the Swedish Empire being eclipsed by Peter the Great's Russia in a huge kind of passing of the torch, which... Obviously, I mean, the rise of Russia affected so much in everything from Napoleon to the First World War. I mean, take the Russian bear out of that equation, everything changes. And the reason why I say take the Russian bear out of the equation is because in 1709, when Charles XII of Sweden, he lost the Battle of Poltava, which basically shattered Sweden's ability to resist its enemies. After 8+ years of fighting on all fronts and defeating all comers, it's almost unfair. Charles XII of Sweden invades Russia, one of the first recorded like invasions of its size, and falls victim to the Russian winter that would later claim so many. And we see early examples of scorched earth and everything. And essentially, he loses the Battle of Poltava and he retreats into Ottoman territory. He basically seeks asylum there. And he recommends to the Ottomans that they declare war on the Russians, which they do. They invade Russia and they send an army 200,000 strong against Peter the Great's not so great force of about 30 or 40,000. And they destroy Peter the Great's army against the River Pruth in the Battle of Pruth. And after they do this, and after Peter is left running for his life, essentially, the Ottomans sue for peace because they feel like they've proved their point. But Charles the 12th is like, no, press the attack, destroy him, he's my enemy, he's our enemy, kind of thing. Suddenly Protestant Sweden wants to cozy up to Muslim mm-hmm. Ottoman Empire. Like, it's the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But as far as the Ottomans were concerned, they didn't need to destroy the Russians. The Russians weren't a threat to them. They just needed to give them a bloody nose and send them on their way. But what if that morning the man who Charles the 12th had to persuade had just been in a more lenient mood and had decided, yeah, okay, we'll just wipe them off the map. We might as well. We can. Let's just do it. So they invade and they press the attack and they send a force in, and Peter is killed in one of these battles, say, and his power base disintegrates and Russia disintegrates itself. And with this, Charles the 12th with Ottoman auxiliaries is able to take the fight back to his enemies, mainly in Poland. And once Russia was the main boogeyman. So once Russia was defeated, he was able to move back into Poland, defeat the Poles, force the Poles to sue for peace. And then once that's done, the only enemy left is the Danes. And then the Danes are defeated, because at this stage, the Danes seem to get defeated a fair bit by the Swedes. So that's another assumption, but there you go. So then Charles the 12th, he never dies, as what does happen when he's besieging the fortress of Frederiksrode in, I think it's Norway or something. Yeah, he's shot in the head and killed instantly. Not a very glamorous way for a Swedish king to go. But it wasn't the first time that a Swedish king had died in battle. And because he lives, he maintains the Swedish Empire, for better or worse. And the Russian Empire, if not ceases to exist, is certainly stunted by the loss of its vibrant leader, Peter the Great, and its basic assassination or annihilation under the Ottoman invasion. I mean, how do you think that removal of Russia or the empowering of Sweden would have affected, well, I suppose, even the next few years?
Well, I mean, this is a fascinating potential for a world building. I mean, it's a real fertile ground, because you have a radically different culture overtaking a culture. So if the Ottomans take over Moscow, you know, now you have mosques in Moscow. I mean, that's a fascinating, and you know, the symbol of the Ottoman Empire is, you know, is the crescent moon. I mean, the symbol of Islam is the crescent moon, which was the moon that was over Constantinople when the Turks conquered it. And so that was the end of that, you know, of that Christian sort of empire, the Byzantines, the Romans. And now here we have, you know, the other arm, you know, the Eastern Orthodox. This is like round two of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's at that scale. So, I mean, we can talk about like this, the Swedes, you know, keep their little territory. But I think the real story is the conquest of Moscow by the Ottoman Turks. It just opens up a world, because now the Ottomans can go east, they can go west, they can go to Europe, they can go to Asia. They can do what Peter the Great did in terms of expanding their empire.
Yeah.
You know, it's a huge block of power. But also, I think it has the potential, just like the Mongols, of overextension. Mm. You know, the Ottomans were already huge. I mean, they were, I think, bigger than the Roman Empire at its height, if you take all of their square miles put together. So if you add Russia into that, I mean, that's just a... That creates a bit of a bureaucratic nightmare.
It does.
And so there's an opportunity for the whole thing to fall apart a lot sooner.
Mm.
But then falling apart into what? Falling apart into, you know, Muslim kingdoms.
Yeah.
You know, and I think where you could create some fun fodder for alternate history, for sort of storytelling, is let's say that you had a great man who was a Shiite who sort of took over the Russian area. And, you know, the Ottomans were Sunni. So now you have a Sunni Shiite, you know, conflict between the Russians and the Turks. You know, something like that would sort of parallel what's going on now in the world. And so it sort of, you know, science fiction sort of tries to take what's going on in the world now and projecting it into an imaginary world. And then you get to sort of play things out on a different sort of palette. There's some interesting things you can do with that.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. And I think what you said there about the Ottoman overextension is interesting, because even if the Ottomans don't basically resurrect themselves, I mean, the last siege of Vienna in 1683, when that failed, historians tend to see, from about the 1700s onwards, the Ottoman decline as kind of ongoing up to the point of the First World War. So even if the Ottomans didn't get like a shot in the arm from expanding into or at least soundly militarily defeating the Russians, you have to ask yourself what Europe would have looked like if there was no Eastern boogeyman over over in the East, especially for the likes of Poland. And the Poles would suffer horrendously with the Russians there, really. They would gradually lose more and more of their independence to the Russians, up to the point in the 1730s when they basically became a Russian vassal. And then they were partitioned in the 1790s, and Poland really ceased to exist. I mean, without the Russians there, or at least with the Russians significantly stunted in this defeat and catastrophic experience, arguably the Poles would have taken advantage, and they would have taken advantage of the fact that the Russians weren't there to stop them, and maybe they would have forged ahead. They could have become the next bulwark to the Turks.
Yeah, and I think that it's not an unrealistic thing that the Turks could have, you know, collapsed at that point, because why did they choose not to go into Russia? You know, they probably had good reason to choose not to. I mean, you don't give up on an opportunity.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Like destroying the army of Peter the Great without good reason. So yeah, they gave up on the opportunity. Had they gone through, they probably would have collapsed or broken up into fiefdoms, and then Poland would have had a great opportunity. Poland and Sweden. I mean, it really would have been an opportunity for Central Europe to really strike out on its own.
Oh, big time! Yeah. And I think a world in which Poland is saved the experiences it goes through, it can only be a good thing considering how badly it suffered.
I mean, you maybe even want to set your story in Poland.
Yeah.
You know, a resurgent Poland.
Yeah.
You know, expanding into the Ottoman Turkish Russia.
And a lot of the reason why this is getting into a bit of I've always found Polish history so fascinating, but a lot of the reason why Poland was declining at this stage was because the Russian influence was seen as so kind of overbearing. Within a generation, much of the Polish nobility is kind of, for the sake of self-interest, they'd given away a lot of their independence to the Russians because they saw greater opportunities for empowering themselves and enriching themselves in Russia. And without Russia being there, they would have invested those resources, I mean, we'd like to presume they would, in Poland itself, in their home country.
Yeah. So make Poland great again.
Yes. That could
And with all those little German states, you know, all disunited around them, I mean, they would have had, that was a huge buffer between them and France. They could have expanded if they wanted into Central Europe more, into Germany and into Russia. I would imagine that they would choose Russia, but because it was sort of to be taken, you know, with, especially if the Ottomans were collapsing and, you know, that was a territory where they had a lot of kinship to.
It is because of the threat that Russia would later pose to the Ottoman Empire and the Eastern question in British foreign policy, which was basically this idea that the Ottomans would be overtaken by the Russians, that the Russians would swoop down and seize Constantinople and block off the straits to international trade, and then they'd expand into the Mediterranean, and incredible stuff, and obviously a massive overestimation of Russian capabilities, but the idea that the Russians are stopped in their infancy in terms of empire before this is even brought about, that's why I think this stood out to me, because it's such a massive reversal to what actually would, well, not necessarily happen, but what people around the 1800s and 1900s, early 1900s, believed was on the way.
Yeah, and of course that completely knocks out the Great Bear. So whatever wars there are in Europe from now on, you don't have to have the visage of this giant bear coming down. Britain, up forming an alliance with the bear and the bear coming in. Unless it's Poland now, I don't know.
Because I feel like Poland is like the kind of Commonwealth or empire, if you like, that would have made, maybe not made European history better, but certainly I feel like the Polish experience and it getting cut up into little pieces by all its neighbors was just a terrible part of history and a really tragic one for Poles. And maybe it's because I have so many Polish friends, it's kind of coming out in me, but I think certainly they would like the idea where Russia is stopped before it gets a chance to do what it later does. With the so many directions you can go, I mean, this is before even talking about the Swedish element, but I suppose a Europe in which the Swedish Empire still exists, the Swedish Empire, it fits neatly into the historical narrative as an empire which rose with Gustavus Adolphus in the 1630s and then was kind of snuffed out with the death of Charles XII in the late 1710s. I don't remember the exact date when Charles XII was killed, but it's almost 100 years. Like, historians salivate when they see a nice little period of history that they can fit everything into. I mean, that takes away from the fact that Sweden was still active in international affairs right up to the Napoleonic Wars. I mean, Bonaparte's even had, I think, one of their generals became a king of Sweden. So it wasn't the case that Sweden just disappeared, but the martial idea, the kind of the values that the Swedes held and their experience of having to maintain a standing army was very similar to what Prussia would later do. And what I would wonder is, does the maintenance of the Swedish Empire prevent the rise of Prussia, or can the two coexist somehow?
Because it never really flourished in the way that it could have.
Yeah.
There's for this, cultural development that would have happened with it being a sort of free state with its own sovereignty and power and influence.
Sure.
And even though it was kind of stuck way up in the north and it wasn't like a central power, it really would sort of that central pull of power north more, pull the weight of diplomacy further north. And so there's some interesting implications there. And it would be interesting to, I love setting stories in places that are just completely different, not always in Germany, not always in like Paris or Berlin or London, but in like somewhere in Sweden would be a fascinating place to explore.
Big time, yeah. What Berlin later tried to do when the Prussians tried to recast Berlin as a kind of, well, mostly under Frederick the Great from about 1740 to the 80s, they tried to present Berlin as the capital of European culture and everything else, and tried to like ignore Paris over there that already had that claim kind of thing.
Right.
But
right.
Would Stockholm have tried to do that? Maybe they would have tried to reinvent themselves culturally, like you said, or maybe in terms of navy, maybe they would have tried to pursue New Sweden. I mean, Sweden did have a few colonies in the New World. Maybe they would have succeeded had the Swedes not been so ruined here. But yeah, I mean, I think this actually leads us into the scenario we have here, which is, what if Tsar Alexander II was never assassinated? This is only our first of two assassination questions. So this one here, what if Tsar Alexander II was never assassinated in 1881? And most people have not heard of Tsar Alexander, but he was actually a very important character in not just Russian foreign affairs, because he was there during the Russo-Turkish War of 1877, which I've covered as part of my Britain Goes to War series. But Tsar Alexander II was actually more important behind the scenes, because he set a lot of reforms in place, and had he not been assassinated, Russian history and Russian society may have progressed very differently. Because as soon as he was killed, his successor, Alexander III, I mean, to put it in context, okay, Alexander II is actually nicknamed Alexander the Liberator, And that's mainly because of the reforms he brought in. But once he was killed, his son Alexander III, basically as a kind of a middle finger to the people that had killed him, he rolled back all the reforms. He made Russia even more autocratic. He got rid of the ideas for kind of representation and increased legislation and a curbing of, like, making Russia more federal in a sense. He basically turned back the clock in Russia even further at a time when they could least afford it. That process kept going then. Really, the rolling back of reforms and the furthering of the autocracy of Russia was carried on to Alexander III's son, who you would have heard because he was Nicholas II. And now, I'm not going to say that had Nicholas II been the son of a son who had not seen his father be assassinated, I'm not going to say if that had happened, would Alexander III and would Nicholas II have faced such trouble, like, domestically? Would Tsar Nicholas II have faced the Russian Revolution or even the 1905 Revolution? Because surely if you further on this logic, I mean, the logical end of Alexander II's reforms, the way, the direction he was going in, was constitutional monarchy, because that's the next step, really. Yeah. He had gone so far by that stage, and he had appeased so many people by giving them what they wanted and bringing an end to a lot of the real awful internal problems that had plagued Russia, like inequality and just the corruption of the nobility and the massive gap between rich and poor.
So he was really, he was kind of keeping with Peter the Great, the modernizer. And yes, he was in the same sort of spirit. You know, I kind of liken Vladimir Putin to Peter the Great. He has a giant picture of Peter the Great over his office, his desk. You know, he likens himself to Peter the Great. So I kind of think of, like, imagine Vladimir Putin was succeeded by another Vladimir Putin. Like you get two of them in a row. Like, Putin is really, you know, say what you want about Putin, whether he's good or bad, but he's really taken Russia and lifted it up and modernized it to the best ability that he can. I mean, he's made it into an energy superpower. But imagine, like, I guess America's hope is that, or the Allies' hope is that it's you're going to get rid of Putin, and then you get someone, you know, a little bit apathetic that goes in next. But what if, you know, you get someone that continues on the tradition of modernizing and just pounding the improvements. And so that's sort of what you get with this guy, Alexander.
Yeah.
So you get it makes the system more efficient. It makes it the labor force more efficient. It allows for industrialization. And you have that industrialization, modernization, education, art, it all sort of rises up a lot sooner, a lot faster. And so you don't get, you know, communism forming within a population that's fairly well satisfied and that owns, you know, a good plot of land and that has hope for the future.
Yeah.
I have a quote here, if you'll let me read it.
It's cool.
It's by Mark Twain, and he was describing Berlin in 1891. And this is sort of, it just made me think of this quote. So he describes Berlin this way. He says, "Gas and the electric light are employed with a wasteful liberty. And so wherever one goes, he has always double ranks of brilliant lights stretching far down into the night on every hand. And here and there, a wide and splendid constellation of them spread out over the intervening plazas. And between the intermittent double procession of street lamps, one has the swarming and darting cab lamps, a lively, pretty addition to the fine spectacle, for they counterfeit the rush and the confusion and the sparkle of an invasion of fireflies." And that sort of makes me think of like what Moscow could have been in the 1890s or you know, the 1900s, had this guy had, you know, modernized them and allowed, you know, cars to come into being and street lamps and industry. So that's sort of my take on it.
I mean, as is my wont, I tend to ignore the more important things, like what the people actually went through, when I look at the grand story of foreign affairs. But you're dead right there. I mean, with a Russian populace that was more satisfied with their lot in life, the logical man would say that the Russian experience would only improve and Russia would become more powerful and more intelligent and more technologically advanced and would, invest itself in industrialism, and there wouldn't be any need for Stalin's five-year plans because Russia would be on par with the likes of Germany by the time of the First World War. And who's to say there would even have been a First World War if things had gone differently and if Alexander II's successors were not so turned off by his reforms because he hadn't been killed, so they didn't see a need to reverse everything he'd done and try and increase their own security. Maybe the Russian czars came to be seen as enlightened despots because...
Well, you get a ruler like Nicholas II, who is really apathetic. Yeah. He wasn't a good ruler, but if the ball has been rolling for over 100 years, and or hundreds of years, I can't remember when Peter the Great was around, but if the ball is in motion. And if he's sort of a constitutional despot or czar, then there's not really much that he can do. He could be like, a Charles I or of Britain, just not particularly fantastic, kind of a nice guy, sort of dawdling around with his dominoes. But, the ball is rolling for Russia. It's going. Things are moving. It's industrialized and it's strong.
Yeah. And I think the idea as well, what this all leads to, really, and why it caught my eye, well, number one, it's very rarely talked about, that it's normally only mentioned in a passing sentence, Tsar Alexander II was killed by anarchists, the end kind of thing, and his son succeeded him. But to me, that was always, it was always a very interesting story, because the fact that Tsar Alexander II was killed at all was significant, because, of course, then the Tsars were fearful for exposing themselves to the dirty, unwashed masses. Mm-hmm. And without that happening, he could have ruled for a few more years. He was getting on in years by then, but say his son succeeded him and everything was going fine and he continued the reforms and Nicholas II did as well. And then there was no real need for the Russian Revolution. So there was no Russian dropout of the First World War, aside from that whole debate, but there was no communism itself.
Yeah.
There was no USSR. Yeah. Like, how different everything would have been had that not occurred. I mean... you could literally go on for hours. No communists, no Cold War, no Stalin.
Well, and what I find fascinating is that some of these assassins, they come at it with sort of this principle, and they end up, by assassinating the person that sort of could be their greatest champion, they end up getting the exact opposite. And yeah. I think that kind of leads nicely into your next one.
Oh, I was just going to say that. Oh, someone's been doing their research. Whoa. Nicely done. Yeah, very good. I think that you hit the nail on the head there, because, of course, the next one is arguably one of the biggest what-ifs in history. It's, of course, the question, what if Franz Ferdinand, the Archduke of Austria, was never assassinated on the 28th of June, 1914? Like that, it's probably one of the most asked what-ifs. So the obvious question, if he had survived, could the First World War still have erupted? But even then, what you just said there, the fact that he was killed by Gavrilo Princip, and the fact that Gavrilo Princip felt the need to shoot him, this man, Franz Ferdinand, who it really represented everything that Gavrilo Princip was against, because he was a Bosnian Serb and the Habsburg monarchy was encroaching on Serbia and all that kind of thing. But the fact of the matter was, as historians have later pointed out, Franz Ferdinand was planning this grand remodeling. Like, say what you will about his character, he was fundamentally disliked by many people higher up in the Austro-Hungarian state, but he had plans to modernize the Habsburg monarchy, and this included turning it into a United States of Greater Austria, which would basically have made it a federal, still absolute monarchy, but... certainly a federal one with a lot more control in each block, like in each region. And this really would have alleviated much of the problems, because in Franz Ferdinand's mind, the last thing that his country should do would be to go to war with Serbia, because the last thing it needed was a war. Mm-hmm. And the ironic thing is that by killing the man who was planning to make everything better, Gavrilo Princip basically doomed his own country, certainly, and the rest of Europe, many would argue, to, well, not just the First World War, but the 20th century and everything awful that century entailed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when we're looking at alternate histories of the First World War and the assassination, I kind of like to go back to what Bismarck said. You know, he created that union of very complex alliances in Europe. And he said, and you probably know the quote. I can't remember the quote, but I remember he said that if there is a war going to break out, it's going to break out in that kind of Serbia, Balkans area. If you remove that as a problem, then does war break out? And I'm not entirely sure, because I mean, you do have Wilhelm II, who is a bit of a warmonger. He liked the idea of war, but would the stimulant be there to actually carry it out?
That's,
I mean, they needed
the thing.
Some kind of bullet, a literal bullet to start it.
That's very true. Yeah, I mean, when people look at this, they often see it going. I mean, it's obvious one or two ways. Either the war still happened, but a little later on and from a different reason, people say, oh, Europe was just dying to go to war and the assassination just gave them the excuse. And for a long time, that made sense to me because it just seemed like the First World War was inevitable and that the things that happened beforehand led up to it. But the more I've looked into it, and with the July Crisis project that I did to coincide with the centenary, what just occurred to me was how many people, if they'd acted even in a slightly different way, that everything could have changed. Even with the assassination, once that had taken place, the Austrians were outraged for a good while, and then the rest of Europe forgot about it, and no one really did or said anything. And now there was a group of people in Austria trying to keep it going. But then even up to the time when Austria declared war, and people were wondering what they should do, and countries were mobilizing, and nothing was really set in stone, and nothing seemed clear. If any man had acted differently at that stage, for whatever reason, had he got up in a different mood, it was an expression I like, had he got up on a different side of the bed that morning, these men that control the destinies of so many peoples, so many things could have changed. So that rant about that aside, what I often find more convincing is the idea that no, Europe was not aching to go to war. The very alliance system that they were all involved in was designed to maintain peace. There was lots of swaggering and saber rattling and foreign competition going around. But if you actually look at the individual countries involved, each one of them had large reasons for not wanting to go to war. And people often talk about the idea of, Germany wanted a preemptive war to get rid of France and Russia. First of all, the problem with that is that Germany as a whole did not want that. The size of the party in Germany that argued for that was the same size as the party in France that argued for a revengeist war against Germany to take back Alsace-Lorraine. Very small, fringe groups of people who argued for this straightforward solution that would solve everything. I mean, the smart man knows that that's a terrible idea. It doesn't make sense. And I know that it doesn't make sense because arguing that Germany would launch, like Bismarck himself once said, preemptive war is like committing suicide from fear of death. Like you're jumping over the bridge because you're afraid that one day you might die. And that really shows it, that the Germans were operating through this entire period from a position of distinct weakness. And in every way that they operated, they acted aggressively and talked belligerently because they believed that they'd already lost the arms race. They lost the naval race to Britain by 1912, which many people forget about. And
yeah, they gave up.
They did. They gave up. And there was actually a notable détente between Britain and Germany to the extent that in early June, before the assassination took place, the Germans and the British were having naval maneuvers together. And the German was the Kaiser was an honorary admiral in the British Navy, like crazy stuff. And he loved the Royal Navy. He was a massive fan of it.
Yeah. You've read Neil Ferguson, I take it then.
Yeah, I have. But I loved a lesser known historian called John Charmley, who wrote a book called Splendid Isolation that examined British foreign policy. And it's almost, because there's such an emphasis on how aggressive Germany was and how it wanted the First World War and made it happen, no one really looks at how aggressive in certain aspects Britain was in terms of trying to involve itself in the war, to the point that you have like two or three men. One big example is Sir Edward Grey, who was the British Foreign Secretary from 1906 to 1916. And because he so fundamentally believed that the best way to ensure British security was to ally Britain with Russia, because he believed that, he thought that there had to be a kind of a boogeyman, and Germany would fit that bill.
Right.
He didn't want Britain to go to war with Germany up until the last moment, when he realized, oh well, if we don't jump in, then Germany will overwhelm France. And but this is just one specific example, but there was
the British and the Germans were the classic allies going back a long time,
even absolutely,
the Napoleonic Wars. I mean, the Prussians were. So the natural allies were Germany and Britain against the natural enemies, which were Britain and France.
Yeah.
So it strikes you as logical that that Britain would have sided with Germany, and illogical that they would have sided with France against Germany. So we actually kind of live in an alternate history.
We do,
where
yeah.
the least likely thing actually happened.
Yeah.
And so we're kind of living through the consequences of that. But it would be interesting to see the more likely thing to have happened, which would have been had, you know, let's say the assassination took place and war was declared, or what other, you know, stimulant you want. Britain and Germany team up against France and just, you know, destroy them, I guess.
Yeah, big time. And I think an interesting thing to look at as well, the fact that the tragic thing, I mean, I always thought of the First World War as an unnecessary tragedy once I knew enough about it to know that it was such a thing. But to me, what really struck me was how on the downturn, arms buildups and aggressive actions were. Like, one big example is the Franco-German arms buildup. And in France, it was in January 1914. There was a huge big scandal going on in the French government for a good while. But the French president, Raymond Poincaré, he was born in Alsace, and he had seen the Germans march through it during the Franco-Prussian War. So he had this deep-seated hatred of Germany, which is understandable because his homeland got annexed, essentially. But he had always pushed for an increase in the French army bills to keep up with Germany, to the point, and now he'd done this so aggressively, now they were a bit literally scraping the barrel of French manpower. But as a result, they were only very, very slightly behind what the Germans could field. And the Germans, knowing this, because they did know this, and knowing that even if they maintained what they were doing, and that even if they stayed ahead of France, they would still have to contend with Russia. So you had these two, basically these two rivals, they were reaching the end of how far they could build up their arms before something had to give. And I don't mean war by that. I mean, they had to pull it back. And a reason why I think they could pull it back is because these moves were becoming, to increase the French army, these moves are becoming increasingly criticized by the Socialist, the Socialist Party, which was led by Jean Juarez, who actually was assassinated after when the war started to break out, because he said, oh no, we can't go to war with our German socialist brethren, kind of thing. And
right.
He was killed by a French nationalist who said, no, we have to attack the German enemy. But people often forget that if the assassination hadn't happened, you were pretty much guaranteed a French governmental change by the autumn of 1914, which would have definitely rolled back, or at least like significantly stunted, the French increases in the army. So that could have led to a détente as well. And there was many elements within the German army and German government that believed that there was just no point in keeping going in this direction, because they couldn't beat combination. It was just too big, too strong.
Right.
So on that note, I think it's good to, before we get too carried away, because this episode's only gone over an hour already. So I'd just like to say a big thanks very much to you, Jordan, for joining me on this grand speculation journey.
Yeah. This is fascinating. I haven't done one of these in a very long time. And, you know, we've known each other since inception. I can't remember when we started years ago. But, you know, we've always sort of been on each other's radars. And so it's nice to sort of team up once in a while to do these types of things.
It is,
yeah.
Especially with the fifth birthday. I felt it was important to get the people who had really been there, been a big part of When Diplomacy Fails' life and story. So it was really nice to have you on, and really nice to talk to you again. And before we go, is there any plugs you'd like to throw out there to the listeners?
Well, sure, yeah. Come check out my podcast, The Twilight Histories. It's a science fiction, you know, alternate history, time travel adventure podcast. And if you enjoy it, you know, go through all the shows. And if you enjoy it, maybe come and become a member. And there's lots of shows in the membership area. I'm working on a book right now, and it's set in one of our I polled members and polled the audience and just asked, you know, which is your favorite world? And it turns out the one that sort of everyone comes back to is this Roman industrial world that was I created right at the very beginning. And it's an industrialized Roman Empire that takes place hundreds of years after Marcus Aurelius continued his expansion and actually put in someone that was capable to follow him. And so, Rome industrializes, it expands, it takes over huge swaths of the world. And so the book's going to take a journey that stretches all over these different parts of the empire. There's going to be lots of travel throughout it and adventures. And yeah, so I've started doing that for members, and I hope you'll join us for the ride.
Okay, well, thank you for joining me for this ride, and I'm sure my listeners would love to check you out. Thanks very much for joining me, Jordan. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Cool.
Bye for now.
Alrighty, you made it out the other end. How about that? I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed looking into different eras of history from a different point of view, and those alternative realities, I mean, most of them are kind of, I suppose you could say, fairly obscure because no one really knows much about them. I mean, obviously I've covered the last one there in more detail, but as far as, I mean, lots of those go, I feel like there's plenty of room to speculate further. So if you guys feel like there's any kind of appetite amongst yourselves for that, then by all means, let me know. Let me know if you think that any of those topics could be done in more detail, and I'll certainly consider it. Let me know as well what you thought about this collaboration episode. And let Jordan Harbour know too, because he's a quality podcaster deserving of your time. Remember to check him out at twilighthistories.com. Alrighty guys, I'm out of here. Thanks very much for listening. I will see you all soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.